Guess too, perhaps fly fishing. But what counts, what really counts, is the way he holds me.
Geralt embraced her, as though she were all the world to him. They didn't get much sleep the first night, and even when litter dropped off, the Witcher found it difficult. Her arm was girdling his waist so tightly he found it hard to breathe, and her leg was thrown across his thighs. The second night she was less possessive. She didn't hold him or hug him as tightly as before, but then she'd stopped fearing he'd run away before dawn.
"You're pensive. You have a gloomy male expression. The reason?"
"I'm wondering about the naturalism of our relationship."
"What do you mean?"
"As I said, naturalism."
"It seems you use the word relationship.
The semantic capacity of that concept is indeed astonishing.
Furthermore, I hear post-coital tristesse intruding on you. A natural state, indeed. It affects all the higher creatures. A strange little tear has come to my eye, too, Witcher."
"Cheer up. Cheer up. I'm joking."
"You lured me, as a buck is lured."
"What?"
"You lured me, like an insect, with magical freesia and apricot pheromones."
"Are you serious?"
"Don't get cross, please, Coral."
"I'm not. Quite the opposite. On second thoughts, I have to admit you're right. Yes, it's naturalism in its purest form, except it's utterly the reverse. It was you who beguiled and seduced me, at first sight. You, naturalistically and animalistically, treated me to a male courtship display. You hopped, stamped, and fluffed up your tail."
"That's not true."
"Fluffed up your tail and flapped your wings like a blackcock. You crowed and clucked."
"No, I didn't."
"Yes, you did."
"Didn't."
"Did. Embrace me."
"Coral."
"What?"
"Little Nair. That isn't your real name, is it?"
"My real one was Troublesome."
"Why so?"
"Try saying quickly, Astrid Lidnir, Asgeir Finnsbjorn's daughter."
"I get it."
"I doubt you do."
"Coral."
"Uh-huh."
"And Mutzaik. Where did she get her nickname?"
"Know what I don't like, Witcher? Questions about other women. And particularly when the Enquirer is lying in bed with me and asks a lot of questions instead of concentrating on the matter in hand."
"You wouldn't dare do anything like that if you were in bed with Yennefer."
"And I don't like certain names being mentioned either, especially when..."
"Shall I stop?"
"I didn't say that."
Coral kissed his arm.
"When she arrived at school, her given name was Ayak. I don't remember her family name. Not only did she have a strange name, but she suffered from a loss of skin pigment. Her cheeks were dotted with pale spots. She indeed looked like a mosaic. She was cured, naturally, after the first semester, for a sorceress cannot have any blemishes. But the spiteful nickname stuck, and quickly stopped being spiteful. She grew to like it herself, but enough of her. Talk to me, and about me. Go on, right now."
"What, right now?"
"Talk about me. What I'm like. Beautiful, aren't I? Go on, say it."
"Beautiful. Red-haired. And freckled."
"I'm not freckled. I magically removed them."
"Not all. You forgot about some of them. But I found them."
"Where are... Oh. Well. All right. True. So I'm freckled. And what else am I?"
"Sweet."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Sweet as a honey wafer."
"You aren't making fun of me, are you?"
"Look at me. Look into my eyes. Do you see even the slightest insincerity in them?"
No. And that's what worries me most. Sit down on the edge of the bed.
Or else?
I want to get my own back.
I beg your pardon.
For the freckles you found where you found them. For your efforts and the thorough exploration. I want to get my own back and repay you. May I?
By all means.
The sorceress's villa, like almost all the villas in that part of the city, had a terrace with a view of the sea stretching out below. Litta liked to sit there and spend hours observing the ships riding at anchor, using a telescope of hefty proportions on a tripod. Geralt didn't really share her fascination with the sea and what sailed on it, but liked to accompany her on the terrace. He sat close, right behind her, with his face beside her red curls, enjoying the scent of freesias and apricots.
"That galleon casting its anchor, look!"
Coral pointed.
"With a blue cross on its flag. That's the Pride of Sintra. It's probably sailing to Kovia. And that cog is Alka from Sidaris, probably taking on a cargo of hides. And over there, that's Tetider, a hulk from here, 400 tons capacity, a freighter, flying between Kerak and Nastrog. And there, see, the Novigradian schooner, Pandora Parvi, sailing to anchor right now. It's a beautiful, beautiful ship. Look into the eyepiece, you'll see it.
I can see without a telescope. I'm a mutant.
Oh, true. I'd forgotten. And over there is the galley Fuchsia. 32 oars. It can take a cargo of 800 tons. And that elegant 3-mast galleon is Vertigo. It sailed from Lan Exeter. And there, in the distance, with the Amaranth flag, is the Redanian galleon Albatross. 3 masts, 120 feet in the beam. Oh, there! Look, look! The post-clipper Echo is setting sail and putting out to sea. I know the captain. He eats at Ravenga's when he anchors here. Oh, there again, look, a galleon from Povis under full sail.
The Witcher brushed Litter's hair from her back. Slowly, one by one, he unfastened the hooks and eyes and slid the dress from the sorceress's shoulders. After that, he utterly devoted his hands and attention to a pair of galleons under full sail. Galleons one would search for in vain on all the maritime routes, harbours, ports and registers of the Admiralty. Litter didn't protest, and didn't take her eyes away from the telescope's eyepiece.
"You're behaving like a 15-year-old," she said at one point, "as if you've never seen breasts before."
"It's always the first time for me," he reluctantly confessed, "and I never really was 15.
"I come from Skellige," she told him later in bed. "The sea's in my blood, and I love it. I dream of sailing away one day," she continued, when he remained silent. "All alone. Set sail and put out to sea. Far, far away. All the way to the horizon. Only water and sky all around. The salt foam splashes me. The wind tugs my hair in an utterly male caress. And I'm alone. Completely alone. Endlessly alone. Among the strange and hostile elements. Solitude amid a sea of strangeness. Don't you dream of that?"
"No, I don't," he thought. "I have it every day."
The summer solstice arrived, and after it a magical night, the shortest of the year, when the flower of the fern bloomed in the forest, and naked girls, rubbed with adder's tongue fern, danced in dew-sprinkled clearings. A night as short as the blink of an eye. A wild night, bright from lightning. He awoke alone in the morning after the solstice. Breakfast was waiting for him in the kitchen. And not just breakfast.
"Good morning, Mosaic. Beautiful weather, isn't it? Where's Litter?"
"You have a day off," she replied without looking at him. "My unparalleled mistress will be busy. Until late. During the time she devoted to pleasure. the list of patients grew.
Patients?
She treats infertility and other women's disorders. Didn't you know? Well, now you do. Good day.
Don't go out yet. I'd like to. I don't know what you'd like to do, she interrupted.
But it's probably a bad idea. It'd be better if you didn't talk to me. Pretend I wasn't here at all.
Coral won't harm you anymore. I give my word. In any case, she's not here. She can't see us.
She sees everything she wants to see. All she needs is a few spells and an artifact. And don't kid yourself that you have any influence on her. That requires more than...
She nodded towards the bedroom.
Please don't mention my name in her presence, not even casually. Because she won't let me forget it. Even if it takes a year, she'll remind me.
Since she treats you like that, can't you simply go?
Go where? She said crossly. To a weaving manufactory? To serve time with a seamstress? Or head at once to a brothel? I don't have anyone. I'm a nobody. And I'll always be a nobody. Only she can change that. I can endure it all. But please, don't make it any worse. I met your pal in town. She glanced at him a moment later. That poet, Dandelion. He asked about you. He was anxious.
Did you calm him down? Explain I was safe, in no danger?
Why should I lie?
I beg your pardon.
You aren't safe here. You're here with her out of sorrow for the other one. But even when you're close to her, you only think about the other one. She knows it. But she plays along, because it pleases her. And you dissemble splendidly. You're awfully convincing. Have you thought about what will happen when you give yourself away? Are you staying with her tonight, too?
Yes, Geralt confirmed.
That'll be a week, did you know?
4 days.
Dandelion strummed the strings of his lute with a dramatic glissando. He looked around the tavern. He swigged from his mug and wiped the froth from his nose.
I know it's not my business, he said, for him unusually emphatically and forcefully. I know I shouldn't meddle. I know you don't like it when anyone meddles, but certain things, Geralt, my friend, ought not to be left unsaid. Coral, if you want to know my opinion, is one of those women who ought to always wear a conspicuous warning sign, one proclaiming, look, but don't touch. In menageries, they put things like that in terrariums containing rattlesnakes.
I know.
She's playing with you and toying with you.
I know.
You, meanwhile, are simply filling the void after Yennefer, whom you can't forget about.
I know.
So why?
I don't know.
They would go out in the evening. Sometimes to the park, sometimes to the hill overlooking the port. Sometimes they simply walked around the spice market. They visited the Natura Rerum Osteria together. Several times. Phoebus Ravenga was beside himself with joy. On his orders, the waiters danced attendance on them. Geralt finally experienced the taste of turbot in cuttlefish ink. And then goose legs in white wine, and veal shank with vegetables. Only at first, and briefly, did the intrusive and ostentatious interest of the other guests bother him. Then he followed Litter's example, and ignored them. The wine from the local cellar helped greatly. Then they returned to the villa. Coral shared her dress in the anterooms and led him, quite naked, to the bedroom. He followed her. His eyes never left her. He adored looking at her.
Coral.
What?
Rumour has it you can always see what you want to see. All you need is a few spells and an artifact.
I think I'll have to twist another of that rumour's joints again.
She lifted herself up on an elbow and looked him in the eyes.
That ought to teach it not to gossip.
Please,
I was joking. She cut him off.
There wasn't a trace of merriment in her voice.
And what would you like to see? She continued, after he had fallen silent. Or have prophesied? How long you're going to live? When and how you'll die? What horse will win the Grand Traetorian? Who the Electoral College will elect as the Hierarch of Novigrad?
who Yennefer is with now.
Litter. What's bothering you, if I may ask?
He told her about the theft of the swords. There was a flash of lightning, and a moment later, a peal of thunder. The fountain splashed very softly. The basin smelt of wet stone. The marble girl was petrified, wet and shining in her dancing position.
The statue and the fountain, Coral hurried to explain, aren't there to satisfy my love for pretentious kitsch, nor are they expressions of subservience to snobbish fashions. They serve more concrete ends. The statue portrays me, in miniature, when I was 15.
Who would have supposed then that you would develop so prettily?
It's a magical artifact powerfully linked to me, while the fountain, or more precisely the water, serves for divination. You know, I think, what divination is.
Vaguely.
The theft of your weapons took place around 10 days ago.
Oneromancy is the best and most certain way of interpreting and analysing past events, even very distant ones. But the rare talent of dream reading, which I don't possess, is necessary for that.
Sortilege or cleromancy won't really help us. Likewise, pyromancy and aeromancy, which are more effective in the case of foretelling people's fates, on condition that one has something belonging to those people. Hair, fingernails, a fragment of clothing or something similar. They can't be used with objects. In our case, swords. And so, all that remains to us is divination.
Litta brushed a red lock from her forehead.
That, as you probably know, lets one see and predict future events. The elements will assist us, for a truly stormy season has set in. We shall combine divination with sironoscopy. Come closer. Grasp my hand and don't release it. Lean over and look into the water, but don't touch it under any circumstances. Concentrate. Think about your swords. Think hard about them.
He heard her chanting a spell. The water in the basin reacted, foaming and rippling more powerfully with every sentence of the formula being uttered. Large bubbles began to rise from the bottom. The water became smooth and cloudy, and then completely clear. Dark, violet eyes look out from the depths. Raven black locks fall onto shoulders and cascades, gleam, reflect light like a peacock's feathers, writhing and rippling with every movement.
The swords, Coral reminded him, quietly and scathingly. You were supposed to be thinking about the swords.
The water swirled. The black-haired, violet-eyed woman disappeared in the vortex. Geralt sighed softly.
Think about the swords, hissed Litta. Not her.
She chanted a spell in another flash of lightning. The statue in the fountain lit up milkily, and the water again calmed and became transparent. And then he saw
his sword, hands touching it, rings on fingers.
Made from a meteorite. The superb balance. The weight of the blade precisely equal to the weight of the hilt.
The other sword, silver. The same hands.
A steel tang edged with silver. Runic characters along the entire length.
I can see them,
he whispered aloud, squeezing Litta's hand.
I can see my swords. Really, quiet, she responded with an even stronger grip. Be quiet and concentrate.
The swords vanish. Instead of them, he sees a black forest, an expanse of stones, rocks. One of the rocks is immense, towering, tall and slender, carved into a bizarre shape by strong winds. The water foamed briefly. A grizzled man with noble features, in a black velvet jacket and a gold brocaded waistcoat, both hands resting on a mahogany lectern.
Lot number 10, he declares loudly. An absolute curio, an exceptional find, two witcher swords.
A large black cat turns around on the spot, trying hard with its paw to reach the medallion on a chain swinging above it. Enamel on the medallion's golden oval, a blue dolphin neant. A river flows among trees beneath a canopy of branches and boughs hanging over the water. A woman in a long, close-fitting dress stands motionless on one of the bows. The water foams briefly and almost immediately becomes calm again. He saw a sea of grass, a boundless plain reaching to the horizon. He saw it from above, as though from a bird's-eye view, or from the top of a hill. A hill down whose slopes descend a row of vague shapes. When they turned their heads, he saw unmoving faces, unseeing dead eyes.
They're dead, he suddenly realized. It's a cortege of the dead.
Litter's fingers squeezed his hand again, with the strength of pliers. A flash of lightning, a sudden gust of wind, tugged at their hair. The water in the basin churned up, seethed, surged with foam, rose in a wave as high as the wall, and tumbled straight down on them. They both leapt back from the fountain. Coral stumbled, and he held her up. Thunder boomed. The sorceress screamed a spell and waved an arm. Lights came on throughout the house. The water in the basin, a moment earlier, a seething maelstrom, was smooth, calm, only being moved by the languidly trickling stream of the fountain. Even though, a moment earlier, a veritable tidal wave had poured over them, there wasn't a single drop of water to be seen. Geralt breathed out heavily and stood up.
"Right at the end," he muttered, helping the sorceress to stand up. "That last image, the hill and that procession of people, I didn't recognize it. I've no idea what it could be."
"Neither do I," she answered in an uneasy voice. "But it wasn't your vision. That image was meant for me. I have no idea what it could mean either. But I have a strange feeling there's nothing good in it."
The thunder fell silent. The storm moved away, inland.
"Charlatanism, or that divination of hers," repeated Dandelion, adjusting the pegs on his lute. "Fraudulent visions for the naive. The power of suggestion, nothing more. You were thinking about swords, so you saw swords. What else do you think you saw? A march of corpses? A terrible wave? A rock with a bizarre shape? Meaning what?" "Something like a huge key," the Witcher pondered. "Or a 2½ heraldic cross."
The troubadour fell into pensive mood, and then dipped his finger into his beer, and drew something on the tabletop.
"Similar to that?"
"Oh, very similar."
"Damn!"
Dandelion plucked the strings, attracting the attention of the entire tavern.
"And blast! Geralt, my friend, how many times have you got me out of trouble? How many times have you helped me, rendered me a favour, without even counting them?"
"Well, now it's my turn. Perhaps I'll help you recover your famed weapons."
"Eh?"
Dandelion stood up.
"Madame Litter Nair, your newest conquest, under whom I hereby return her honour as an outstanding diviner and unrivalled clairvoyant, has indicated, in her divination, a place I know. In an obvious, clear way, leaving no room for doubt. We're going to see Ferron, at once. He'd have to arrange an audience for us, using his shadowy connections, and issue you with a pass to leave the city by the official gate, in order to avoid a confrontation with those harpies from the guardhouse. We're going on a little outing, and actually not too far from here."
"Where to?"
"I recognize the rock in your vision. Something experts call a mogot, and local residents the griffin. A distinctive point, simply a signpost leading to the home of the person who may in fact know something about your swords. The place we're heading for bears the name Ravelin. Does that ring a bell?"
It is not only the execution and the excellence of the craft that determine the quality of a witch's sword. As with mysterious elven or gnomish blades whose secret has been lost, the mysterious power of a witch's sword is bound to the hand and skill of the witcher wielding it. And, forsooth, owing to that magic's mysteries, it is greatly potent against the dark powers. Pandolfo Forteguera, A Treatise on Edged Weapons.
"I shall reveal one secret to you, about witcher swords. It's poppycock that they have some kind of secret power, and that they are supposedly wonderful weapons. That there are no better ones.
It's all fiction, invented for the sake of appearances. I know this from a quite certain source.
Dandelion, half a century of poetry. Chapter 8. They recognized the rock called the Griffin at once. It was visible a long way off. The place they were aiming for was located more or less halfway along the route from Kerak to Sidaris, some way from the road linking the two cities, which wound among forests and rocky wildernesses. The journey took them some time, time they killed with idle chatter, mainly contributed by Dandelion.
"Common knowledge claims that swords used by wishers have magical properties," said the poet. "Passing over the fabrications about sexual impotence, there must be some truth in it. Your swords aren't ordinary. Would you like to comment?"
Geralt reined in his mare. Bored by the protracted stay in the stables, Roach's urge to gallop was growing.
"Yes, I would. Our swords aren't ordinary swords."
"It's claimed that the magical power of your witcher weaponry, fatal to the monsters you fight, resides in the steel from which they are forged," said Dandelion, pretending not to hear the mockery. "From the very metal, that is the ores found in meteorites fallen from the sky."
"How so?
Meteorites aren't magical after all. They're a natural phenomenon, accounted for by science. Where's that magic to come from?"
Geralt looked at the sky darkening from the north. It looked like another storm was gathering, and that they could expect a soaking.
"As far as I recall," he said, answering a question with a question, "you have studied all 7 liberal arts, and I graduated summa cum laude. You attended the lectures of Professor Lindenbrock as part of the astronomy course within the quadrivium."
"Oh, Lindenbrock, known as Fiddlefaddle," laughed Dandelion. "Why, of course. I can still see him scratching his backside and tapping his pointer on maps and globes, wittering on monotonously.
Desvera mundi, subdividitor into 4 elementary parts, the earthly part, the aqueous, the aerial, and the igneous. Earth and water form the globe, which is surrounded on all sides, by air, or air. Over the air, stretches the ether, fiery air or fire. Above the fire, meanwhile, are the subtle, sidereal heavens known as the firmamentum, which is spherical in character. On that is located the errant sideria, or wandering stars, and fixer sideria, or fixed stars."
"I don't know what to admire more, your talent for mimicry or your memory," Geralt snorted. "Returning, meanwhile, to the issue of interest to us, meteorites, which our good Fiddlefaddle termed falling stars, sidereal cadens, or something like that, break off from the firmament and fall downwards to burrow into our good old earth. Along the way, meanwhile, they penetrate all the other planes, that is, the elemental planes, as well as the para-elemental planes, for such are also said to exist. The elements and para-elements are imbued, as is known, with powerful energy, the source of all magic and supernatural force, and the meteorite, penetrating them, absorbs and retains that energy. Steel, smelted from a meteorite, and also blades forged from such steel, contains a great deal of such elements. It's magical. The entire sword is magical. Quod erat demonstrandum. Do you understand?"
"Certainly."
"So forget it, because it's poppycock."
"What?"
"Poppycock. Fabrication. You don't find meteorites under every bush. More than half the swords used by witches were made from steel from magnetic ores. I used them myself. They're as good as the ones that fell from the sky when it comes to the siderites penetrating the elements. There is absolutely no difference. But keep it to yourself, Dandelion, please. Don't tell anyone."
"What? I'm to stay silent? You can't demand that. What's the point of knowing something if you can't show off the knowledge?"
"Please. I prefer to be thought of as a supernatural creature armed with a supernatural weapon. They hire me to be that and pay me to be that. Normality, meanwhile, is the same as banality, and banality is cheap. So, I ask you to keep your trap shut. Promise?"
"Have it your way. I promise."
They recognized the rock called the Griffin at once. It was visible a long way off. Indeed, with a little imagination, it could be interpreted as a griffin's head set on a long neck. However, as Dandelion observed, it more resembled the fingerboard of a lute or another stringed instrument. The griffin, as it turned out, was an Inselberg dominating a gigantic crater. The crater, Geralt recalled the story, was called the Elven Fortress because of its fairly regular shape, which suggested the ruins of an ancient building, with walls, towers, bastions, and all the rest. There had never been any fortress there, elven or other. The shapes of the crater were a work of nature, a fascinating work, admittedly. "Down there," Dandelion pointed, standing up in his stirrups. "Do you see? That's our destination, Ravlin." And the name was particularly apt, as the Inselberg described the astonishingly regular shape of a large triangle, extending out from the elven fortress like a bastion. A building resembling a fort rose up inside the triangle, surrounded by something like a walled fortified camp. Geralt recalled the rumours circulating about Ravlin, and about the person who dwelt there. They turned off the road. There were several entrances beyond the first wall, all guarded by sentries armed to the teeth, easily identifiable as mercenaries by their multicoloured and diverse apparel. They were stopped at the first guard post. Although Dandelion loudly referred to a previously arranged audience and emphatically stressed his good relations with the commanders, they were ordered to dismount and wait. For quite a long time. Geralt was becoming somewhat impatient when finally a bruiser resembling a galley slave appeared and told them to follow him. It soon turned out that he was leading them by a circuitous route to the back of the complex, from the centre of which they could hear a hubbub and the sound of music. They crossed a drawbridge. Just beyond it lay a man, semi-conscious and groping around himself. His face was bloodied and so puffy that his eyes were almost completely hidden beneath the swelling. He was breathing heavily, and each breath blew bloody bubbles from his smashed nose. The bruiser leading them didn't pay any attention to the man on the ground, so Geralt and Dandelion pretended not to see anything either. They were in a place where it didn't behove them to display excess curiosity. It was recommended not to stick one's nose into Ravlin's affairs. In Ravlin, so the story went, a nose thus stuck usually parted company with its owner, and remained where it had been stuck. The bruiser led them through a kitchen, where cooks were bustling around hectically. Cauldrons bubbled, and Geralt noticed crabs, lobsters and crayfishes cooking in them. Conger eels squirmed in vats, and clams and mussels simmered in large pots. Meat sizzled in huge frying pans. Servants seized trays and bowls full of cooked food to carry them away down corridors. The next rooms were filled, for a change, with the scent of women's perfume and cosmetics. Over a dozen women in various stages of déshabille, including total undress, were touching up their makeup before a row of mirrors, jabbering away ceaselessly. Here, also, Geralt and Dandelion maintained inscrutable expressions and didn't let their eyes wander inordinately. In the next room, they were subjected to a thorough body search. The characters carrying this out were severe of appearance, professional of manner, and resolute of action. A dagger was confiscated from Geralt. Dandelion, who never carried any weapons, was relieved of a comb and a corkscrew. But, after a moment's thought, he was allowed to keep his loot. "There are chairs in front of His Excellency," they were finally instructed. "Sit down on them. Sit down and do not stand up until His Excellency commands. His Excellency is not to be interrupted when he speaks. You are not to speak until His Excellency gives a sign that you may. And now enter through this door." "His Excellency," muttered Geralt. "He was once a priest," the poet muttered back. "But don't worry. He never assumed much of a priestly manner. His subordinates have to address him somehow, and he can't bear to be called boss. We don't have to use his title." When they entered, their way was immediately barred by something. That something was as big as a mountain and smelled strongly of musk.
"Watch him, Mikita," Dandelion greeted the mountain.
The giant, addressed as Mikita, clearly the bodyguard of His Excellency the Boss, was a half-breed, the result of a cross between an ogre and a dwarf. The result was a bald dwarf with a height of well over 7 feet, quite without a neck, sporting a curly beard with teeth protruding like a wild boar's and arms reaching down to his knees. It was rare to see such a cross. The two species, as could be observed, were quite at variance genetically. Something like Mikita couldn't have arisen naturally. It couldn't have happened without the help of extremely powerful magic. Forbidden magic, incidentally. Rumour had it that plenty of sorcerers ignored the ban, proof of those rumours' veracity was standing before Geralt. They sat down on two wicker chairs in accordance with the prevailing protocol. Geralt looked around. Two scantily dressed young women were pleasuring each other on a large chaise longue in the furthest corner of the chamber. Watching them, while feeding a dog at the same time, was a small, inconspicuous, hunched and unremarkable man in a loose, flowery embroidered robe and a fez with a tassel. Having fed the dog the last piece of lobster, the man wiped his hands and turned around.
"Greetings, Dandelion," he said, sitting down in front of them on something deceptively similar to a throne, though it was made of wicker. "Good day, Master Geralt of Rivia."
His Excellency, Pyrrol Pratt, considered, not without reason, the head of organized crime in the entire region, looked like a retired silk merchant. He wouldn't have looked out of place at a retired silk merchant's picnic, and wouldn't have been singled out as an impostor. At least, not from a distance. A closer look would have revealed in Pyrrol Pratt what other silk merchants didn't have. An old, faded scar on his cheekbone. A mark left by a knife. The ugly and ominous grimace of his thin mouth. A pair of bright, yellowish eyes, as unmoving as a python's. No one broke the silence for a long time. Music drifted in from somewhere outside, and a hubbub could be heard.
"I'm very pleased to see you and greet you both," Pyrrol Pratt said finally.
An old and unquenched love for cheap, crudely distilled alcohol could clearly be heard in his voice.
"I'm particularly glad to welcome you, singer."
His Excellency smiled at Dandelion.
"We haven't seen you since my granddaughter's wedding, which you graced with a performance, and I was just thinking about you. Because my next granddaughter is in a hurry to get married. I trust that this time you won't refuse again, for old time's sake. Well, will you sing at the wedding? I won't have to keep asking you like last time. I won't be forced to convince you." I'll sing,
Dandelion, blanching slightly, hurried to assure him.
"And today you dropped in to ask about my health, I imagine,"
continued Pratt.
"Well, it's shitty, this health of mine."
Dandelion and Geralt made no comment. The ogre dwarf reeked of musk. Pyrrol Pratt sighed heavily.
"I've gone down with stomach ulcers and food phobia," he announced. "So the delights of the table aren't for me now. I've been diagnosed with a sick liver and ordered not to drink. I've got a herniated disc which affects in equal measure both my cervical and lumbar vertebrae, and has ruled out hunting and other extreme sports from my pastimes. Medicaments and treatments eat up a great deal of my money, which I formerly used to spend on gambling. My John Thomas, admittedly, let's say, still rises, but how much effort it takes to keep it up. The whole thing bores me before it gives me pleasure. So, what's left, eh?"
"Politics?"
Pyrrol Pratt laughed so much the tassel on his fez shook.
"Well done, Dandelion. Apt as ever. Politics. Ah, yes, that's something for me now. At first I wasn't favourably disposed to the matter. I thought rather to earn a living from harlotry and invest in bawdy houses. I moved among politicians and came to know countless of them, and became convinced it'd be better to give up on whores, for whores at least have their honour and some sort of principles. On the other hand, though, it's better to govern from the town hall than from a brothel. And one would like to run, if not the country, as they say, then at least the county. The old adage goes, if you can't beat 'em, join 'em."
He broke off and glanced at the chaise longue, craning his neck.
"Don't sham, girls!"
he yelled.
"Don't put it on! More gusto!" Where was I? Politics. Ah, yes. But leaving politics aside, you, Witcher, have had your famous sword stolen. Isn't it owing to that matter that I have the honour of welcoming you?
For that matter, indeed.
Someone stole your swords.
Pratt nodded.
A painful loss, methinks. Painful, no doubt, and irretrievable. I've always said that Carrack's crawling with thieves. Give the people there one chance, and they'll swipe anything that isn't nailed down, it's well known. And they always carry a crowbar with them in case they chance on anything nailed down. The investigation, I trust, continues,
he went on a moment later.
Ferrand de Lettenhover taking action. Stare truth in the eyes, though, gentlemen. You can't expect miracles from Ferrand. No offence, Dandelion, but your relative would be a better accountant than an investigator. With him it's nothing but books, legal codes, articles, rules. Well, that and evidence, evidence, and once again that evidence of his. Like that story about the goat and the cabbage. Know it? They once locked a goat in a barn with a head of cabbage. In the morning there wasn't a trace of it, and the goat was shitting green. But there was no evidence or witnesses, so they dismissed the case causa finita. I don't like to be a prophet of doom, Witcher Geralt, but the case of your sword's theft may end up likewise.
Geralt didn't comment this time either.
The first sword is steel.
Pyrrell Pratt rubbed his chin with a beringed hand.
Siderite steel, iron ore from a meteorite. Forged in Mahakam in the Dwarven Hammerworks. Total length 40.5 inches. The blade alone 27¼. Splendid balance. The weight of the blade is precisely equal to the weight of the hilt. The entire weapon certainly weighs less than 40 ounces. The execution of the hilt and crossguard is simple but elegant. And the second sword of a similar length and weight is silver. Partially, of course. A steel tang fitted with silver, also the edges are steel, since pure silver is too soft to be sharpened effectively. On the crossguard and along the entire length of the blade there are runic signs and glyphs, considered by my experts indecipherable, but undoubtedly magical.
A precise description.
Geralt was stony-faced.
As though you'd seen the swords.
I have indeed. They were brought to me, and I was invited to buy them. The broker, representing the interests of the current owner, a person of impeccable reputation, and known to me personally, pledged that the swords were acquired legally, that they came from a find in Fen Khan, an ancient necropolis in Sodden. Endless treasures and artifacts have been unearthed in Fen Khan, hence, in principle, there were no grounds to question the source's veracity. I had my doubts, though, and didn't buy the swords. Are you listening to me, Witcher?
I'm hanging on your every word, waiting for the conclusion and the details.
The conclusion is as follows. You scratch my back. Details cost money. Information has a price tag.
Come on! Dandelion said irritably. Our old friendship brought me here, along with a friend in need. Business is business,
Pyrrell Pratt interrupted him.
I said the information I possess has its price. If you want to find something out about the fate of your swords, Witcher from Rivia, you have to pay.
What's the price on the tag?
Pratt took out a large gold coin from under his robe and handed it to the ogre dwarf, who, without visible effort, snapped it in his fingers as though it were a biscuit. Geralt shook his head.
A pantomime cliché, he drawled. You hand me half a coin, and someone, someday perhaps even in a few years, shows up with the other half and demands that I fulfil his wish, which I will have to fulfil unconditionally. Nothing doing. Is that supposed to be the price? No deal. Causa finita. Let's go, Dandelion.
Don't you care about regaining your swords?
Not that much.
I suspected so. But it doesn't harm to try. I'll make another offer. This time one you won't refuse.
Let's go, Dandelion.
You can leave, but through another door.
Pratt indicated with his head.
That one. after first getting undressed. You leave in naught but your long johns.
Geralt thought he was controlling his facial expression. He must have been mistaken, because the ogre dwarf suddenly yelled in warning and moved towards him, raising a hand and stinking twice as much as before.
"This is some kind of joke,"
Dandelion pronounced loudly, as usually bold and mouthy at the witch's side.
"You're mocking us, Pyrrol, which is why we will now say farewell and leave, and by the same door we came in through. Don't forget who I am. I'm leaving."
"I don't think so."
Pyrrol Pratt shook his head.
"You once proved you aren't that clever, but you're too clever to try to leave now."
In order to emphasize the weight of his boss's words, the ogre dwarf brandished a clenched fist the size of a watermelon. Geralt said nothing. He'd been observing the giant for a long time, searching for a place sensitive to a kick, because it looked like a kicking was inevitable.
"Very well."
Pratt appeased his bodyguard with a gesture.
"I'll yield a little. I'll demonstrate goodwill and a desire for compromise. The entire local industrial and commercial elite, financiers, politicians, nobility, clergy, and even an incognito prince are gathered here. I promised them a show the like of which they've never seen before, and they've certainly never seen a witcher in his smalls. But let it be. I'll yield a tad. You'll go out naked to the waist. In exchange, you'll receive the promised information right away. Furthermore, as a bonus..."
Pyrrol Pratt picked up a small sheet of paper from the table.
"As a bonus, 200 Novigradian crowns for the Witcher's pension fund. Here you are. A bearer check on the Gincardi's bank to be cashed at any branch. What do you say to that?"
"Why do you ask?" Geralt squinted his eyes. "You made it clear. I understood that I can't refuse."
"You understood right. I said it was an offer you can't refuse, but mutually beneficial, methinks."
"Take the check, Dandelion."
Geralt unbuttoned his jacket and took it off.
"Speak, Pratt."
"Don't do it." Dandelion blanched even more. "Unless you know what's on the other side of the door?"
"Speak, Pratt."
"As I mentioned..."
His Excellency lounged on his throne.
"I declined to purchase the swords from the broker. But because it was, as I've already said, a person who is well known to me and trusted, I suggested another more profitable way of selling them. I advised that their present owner put them up for auction at the Borsodi Brothers Auction House in Novigrad. It's the biggest and most renowned collector's fair. Lovers of rarities, antiques, recherché works of art, unique objects and all kinds of curiosities descend on it from all over the world, in order to come into possession of some kind of marvel for their collections. Those cranks bid like madmen. The various exotic peculiarities often go for titanic sums at the Borsodi Brothers. Nowhere else are things sold so dearly."
"Speak, Pratt."
The Witcher took off his shirt.
"I'm listening."
"The auction at the Borsodi's occurs once a quarter. The next one will be held in July, on the 15th. The thief will undoubtedly appear there with your swords. With a bit of luck, you'll manage to get them off him before he puts them up for auction."
"And is that all?"
"That's plenty."
"The identity of the thief, or the broker?"
"I don't know the thief's identity," Pratt interjected, "and I won't reveal the broker's. This is business. Laws, rules, and, no less important than that, customs apply. I'd lose face. I revealed something to you big enough for what I demand from you. Lead him out into the arena, Mikita, and you come with me, Dandelion. We can watch. What are you waiting for, Witcher?"
"I have to go out without a weapon, I understand. Not just bare to the waist, but bare-handed too."
"I promised my guests something they'd never seen before,"
explained Pratt slowly, as though to a child.
"They've seen a Witcher with a weapon."
"Of course."
he found himself in an arena, on sand, in a circle marked out by posts sunk into the ground, flooded by the flickering light of numerous lanterns hung on iron bars. He could hear shouts, cheers, applause and whistles. He saw faces, open mouths and excited eyes above the arena. Something moved opposite him, at the very edge of the arena, and jumped. Geralt barely managed to arrange his forearms into the heliotrope sign. The spell thrust back the attacking beast. The crowd yelled as one. The two-legged lizard resembled a wyvern, but was smaller, the size of a large Great Dane. Its head, though, was considerably larger than a wyvern's, and it had a much toothier maw, and a much longer tail, tapering to a thin point. The lizard brandished it vigorously, sweeping the sand and lashing the posts. Lowering its head, it leapt at the witcher again. Geralt was ready, struck with the Ard sign, and repelled it. But the lizard managed to lash him with the end of its tail. The crowd yelled again. Women squealed. The witcher felt a ridge as thick as a sausage, growing and swelling on his naked shoulder. He knew now why he had been ordered to strip. He also recognized his opponent. It was a Vigilosaur, a specially bred, magically mutated lizard used for guarding and protection. Things looked pretty bad. The Vigilosaur treated the arena as though it were its lair. Geralt was thus an intruder to be overpowered and, if necessary, eliminated. The Vigilosaur circled the arena, rubbing itself against the posts, hissing furiously, and attacked again, swiftly, leaving no time for a sign. The witcher dodged nimbly out of range of the toothy jaws, but couldn't avoid being lashed by the tail. He felt another ridge swelling beside the first. The heliotrope sign again blocked the charging Vigilosaur. The lizard's tail whistled as it whirled around. Geralt's ear caught a change in the note. Hearing it a second before the end of the tail struck him across the back. The pain was blinding, and blood ran down his skin. The crowd went crazy. The signs weakened. The Vigilosaur circled him so fast that the witcher could barely keep up. He managed to elude two lashes of the tail, but not the third, and was struck again with a sharp edge on the shoulder blade. The blood was now pouring down his back. The crowd roared. The spectators were bellowing and leaping up and down. One of them leaned far over the balustrade to get a better view, resting on an iron bar holding a lantern. The bar broke and tumbled down with a lantern onto the arena. It stuck into the sand, and the lantern struck the Vigilosaur's head, bursting into flames. The lizard threw it off, spraying a cascade of sparks around, and hissed, rubbing its head against the piles of the arena. Geralt saw his chance at once. He tore the bar out of the sand, took a short run up, and jumped, thrusting the spike hard into the lizard's skull. It passed straight through. The Vigilosaur struggled and clumsily, flapping its forepaws, fought to rid itself of the iron rod penetrating its brain. Hopping uncoordinatedly, it finally lurched into the posts and sank its teeth into the wood. It thrashed around convulsively for some time, churning the sand with its claws and lashing with its tail. Eventually it stopped moving. The walls shook with cheers and applause. Geralt climbed out of the arena up a rope ladder somebody had lowered. The excited spectators crowded around him. A man slapped him on his swollen shoulder, and Geralt barely refrained himself from punching him in the face. A young woman kissed him on the cheek. Another, even younger, wiped the blood from his back with a cambric handkerchief, which she immediately unfolded and displayed triumphantly to her friends. Another, much older woman, took a necklace from her wrinkled neck and tried to give it to him. His expression sent her scuttling back into the crowd. There was a reek of musk, and the ogre dwarf, Makita, forced his way through the crowd like a ship through seaweed. He shielded the witcher and led him out. A physician was summoned, who dressed Geralt and stitched up his wounds. Dandelion was very pale. Pyrrol Pratt was calm, as though nothing had happened. But the witcher's face must have spoken volumes as he hurried to explain.
Incidentally, that bar, previously filed through and sharpened, ended up in the arena on my orders.
Thanks for hurrying it up.
My guests were in seventh heaven. Even Mayor Coppenrath was so pleased he was beaming, and it's hard to satisfy that awesome. He sniffs at everything, gloomy as a brothel on a Monday morning. I have the position of councillor in my pocket. And maybe I'll rise higher if... Would you perform in a week, Geralt, with a similar show?
Only if you're in the arena instead of a Vigilosaur, Pratt. The Witcher wriggled his sore shoulder furiously.
That's good. Hear what a jester he is, Dandelion.
I heard, confirmed the poet, looking at Geralt's back and clenching his teeth. But it wasn't a joke. It was quite serious. I also equally solemnly declare that I shan't be gracing your granddaughter's nuptial ceremony with a performance. You can forget it after the way you've treated Geralt. And that applies to any other occasions, including christenings and funerals, yours included.
Pyrrell Pratt shot him a glance, and something lit up in his reptilian eyes.
You aren't showing me respect, singer, he drawled. You aren't showing me respect again. You're asking to be taught a lesson in this regard, one you won't forget.
Geralt went closer and stood in front of him. Mikita panted, raised a fist, and there was a reek of musk. Pyrrell Pratt gestured him to calm down.
You're losing face, Pratt, said the Witcher slowly. You've done a deal. Classically, according to rules, and no less important than them, customs. Your guests are satisfied with the spectacle. You've gained prestige and the prospect of a position on the town council. I've gained the necessary information. You scratch my back. Both parties are content. So now we should part without remorse or anger. Instead of that, you're resorting to threats. You're losing face. Let's go, Dandelion.
Pyrrell Pratt blanched slightly, then turned his back on them.
I was planning to treat you to supper, he tossed over his shoulder. But it looks like you're in a hurry. Farewell, then. But think yourself lucky I'm letting you both leave Ravelin scot-free. I usually punish a lack of respect, but I'm not stopping you.
Quite right.
Pratt turned around.
What did you say?
Geralt looked him in the eyes.
You aren't especially clever, though you like to think otherwise. But you're too clever to try to stop me.
Scarcely had they passed the hillock and arrived at the first roadside poplars than Geralt reined in his horse and listened.
They're following us.
Damn it!
Dandelion's teeth chattered.
Who? Pratt's thugs?
It doesn't matter who. Go on, ride as fast as you can to Kerak. Hide at your cousin's. First thing tomorrow, take that check to the bank. Then we'll meet at the Crab and Garfish.
What about you?
Don't worry about me. Geralt, be quiet and spur on your horse. Ride, fly.
Dandelion obeyed, leaned forward in the saddle, and spurred his horse to a gallop. Geralt turned back, waiting calmly. Riders emerged from the gloom. Six riders.
The Witcher Geralt.
It is I.
You're coming with us,
the nearest one croaked, reaching for Geralt's horse.
But no foolishness, do you hear?
Let go of my reins, or I'll hurt you.
No foolishness.
The rider withdrew his hand.
Don't be hasty. We be legal and lawful. We ain't no cut purses. We're on the orders of the prince.
What prince?
You'll find out. Follow us.
They set off. Geralt recalled Pratt had claimed some sort of prince was staying in Ravelin, incognito. Things were not looking good. Contacts with princes were rarely pleasant, and almost never ended well. They didn't go far, only to a tavern at a crossroads, smelling of smoke, with lights twinkling. They entered the main chamber, which was almost empty, not counting a few merchants eating a late supper. The entrance to the private chambers was guarded by two armed men wearing blue cloaks, identical in colour and cut to the ones Geralt's escort were wearing. They went in.
Your princely grace, get out! And you, sit down, Witcher.
The man sitting at the table wore a cloak similar to that of his men, but more richly embroidered. His face was obscured by a hood. There was no need. The cresset on the table only illuminated Geralt. The mysterious prince was hidden.